The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And greetings, everybody. I'm John Lufter. Today, our guest on the program is Dr. Georgia Sadler. She is a professor of surgery at the University of California in San Diego School of Medicine and also the Associate Director for Community Outreach at the UCSD Moores Cancer Center. We're going to be talking about new cancer treatments and somewhat cancer prevention. Better not to get than to try to recover from it. But what are the new progress steps being made in that area? Jim will be talking to Dr. Sadler later in the program.
Well, let's head on to today's topic. And today's topic relates to a lot of what you've seen in the news recently. It's called tax inversions. And we'll talk about what that means, but it's been in the headlines as companies try to move their tax jurisdiction out of the United States, which has the highest corporate tax rates in the world, to other jurisdictions and other countries where the taxes are much lower. What most people try to do is to minimize their taxes. Well, retirees have been doing this for quite a long time. Now, Washington's upset about this because they believe that corps just trying to get out of paying their taxes. So today, we're going to talk about tax inversions and retirement outcomes, how that can change dramatically. Retirees, actually, folks, have been playing the tax inversion game for decades now. What we hope to show you today is how it can dramatically impact your retirement lifestyle just by changing your tax jurisdiction, not to mention the cost of living.
You know, it's really funny. I was talking with Stephen Moore, who writes for Forbes and Wall Street Journal periodically. He's with Heritage right now. We were discussing this very thing a week ago. I said, Stephen, I don't get it. Why the politicians don't figure out you lower the tax rates, the economy booms, you get more taxes. And he said, duh. You know, they can't seem to figure this one out. You know, they just keep thinking there's some kind of a static world relationship between you raise the tax rates and you get more taxes. And that's simply not true. But let's explain what corporate inversions are. You hear about that a lot, by the way, and why the president is so upset about that. And bear in mind, we're not opposed to corporations paying tax. In other words, that they shouldn't be paying tax. The problem is when the taxation becomes so distorted, the way we have our ridiculous system here in this country, then people say, well, enough of that. And then they try to avoid the tax, not to mention evade, which is legal in some cases. But anyway, why is the president so upset? Before we talk about retirement inversions, we need to understand this.
Well, let's talk about what a corporate inversion is. A corporate inversion as a strategy is used by companies that receive a significant portion of their income from foreign sources, since that income could be possibly taxed twice, taxed both abroad and in the country of incorporation. So if you're a U.S. corporation, you have profits that are earned overseas, you pay taxes to the countries in which that profit is earned, and also you pay taxes here in the U.S., which is where you're domiciled. Now, companies undertaking this strategy are likely, like anybody else, to select a country that has a lower tax rate. There's less stringent corporate governance requirements. And the way they do that, John, is what you're seeing in the news today. One way a company can reincorporate abroad is by having a foreign company buy its current operations. Assets are then owned by the foreign company, and the old incorporation, in this case in the U.S., is dissolved. For years now, the majority of its revenues from many U.S. sales in the early 50s and 60s, you know, most companies here were making the majority of their sales, with the U.S. being the dominant economy here in the U.S. But gradually, as international cooperation, the linkage between economies and markets have grown, many companies today get a good majority of their profits from overseas. So one of the ways to get around this, the U.S. has a high tax rate, is to do the corporate inversion.
That sounds interesting. So basically, I mean, a company is just trying to reduce the tax burden that it's under. They're being taxed twice in some cases, and you know, you can't blame people. People always act, and that would include corporations and the stockholders in them. They will always act in their own economic best interest. And this game has gone on for as long as taxation.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing in terms of corporate dividends. Corporate dividends are taxed twice when a company, let's just take IBM, makes a profit here. IBM has to pay a corporate tax rate of 35%, the highest in the world. Then, when IBM distributes part of that profit to you, a shareholder, in the form of a dividend, you don't get a deduction for that. Then you pay taxes at the dividend tax rate. Now, a number of years ago, under President Bush, they reduced dividends from being taxed as ordinary income to a special tax rate, depending on which income bracket you fall in, whether you're in the Bush tax bracket, which is single $400,000 of income or less, and $450,000 if you're a married couple. Over that rate, you pay 20%. So dividends are taxed at a 20% rate. And then, of course, if you have $250,000 as a single individual, $300,000 as a married couple, you also pay the Obama tax on dividends of 3.8%. So dividend tax, John, could be 23.8 or 18.8, depending on which bracket you fall in, the Bush or the Obama taxes. And so corporate income is taxed twice, not to mention the fact that many U.S. multinationals have a good majority of their income from overseas. For example, Coca-Cola gets over 54% of its revenues from overseas. So it's paying taxes to those governments, and then it's also paying taxes to the U.S. government. So in many ways, they're paying multiple taxes.
So just as companies choose to lower taxes, you can't blame them for trying to do that given where the tax rates are at. Individuals are doing the same thing. As I mentioned, everybody's going to act in their own economic self-interest. And we even discover that a lot of times politicians or people who make bold public pronouncements about how people should be paying their fair share, when it comes to their own taxes, don't act that way. They act in their own economic best interest. Now, I would suspect, Jim, that cost of living, which is oftentimes tied to the hidden tax of inflation, would also be a factor here.
Well, it's probably a combination of both taxes and the cost of living. I mean, we do find a correlation of high cost of living costs with states that have high taxes. So by moving from, let's say, a high tax state to a lower tax state, you're going to lower your income taxes, which in many cases can be significant. Not only income taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, and also you'll find that sometimes you can significantly lower your living expenses. So if you take a look at not only lowering your living expenses by moving to a place where it's cheaper to live, but also where a state that either has no taxes or low taxes, it's sort of a win-win strategy for somebody thinking about retirement.
You know, you have to recognize that this is more important today than it was previously, especially since we've been in this low interest rate environment for 7 years at about 0% rates. We're going to be that way for quite some time, given the way things are looking right now. And so this is actually an important factor, whereas before it really wasn't quite the same thing. So what other factors, though, do you think are contributing to these tax inversions that affect retirees?
Well, I think it's probably a combination. I mean, if you take a look at the last 13 years, we've had two bear markets in stocks. So retirees have less money than they thought they were going to have when they were originally planning or saving for retirement. I think another factor, which is even greater, is this low interest rate environment. In fact, we got the FOMC meeting minutes from the last FOMC meeting where they're saying, hey, we're not in any hurry to start raising interest rates anytime soon, especially given weak economic growth. We just had the IMF come out and lower economic growth, for probably the third or fourth time since we're probably in the fourth quarter. Maybe economic growth isn't where they thought it is. So it looks like we're in this low interest rate environment. And John, I would say low interest rates has probably been one of the single biggest factors, because when most people retire, they shift towards safer assets, you know, certificates of deposit at the bank, treasury bills, fixed income, things that are predictable and safer than, let's say, the stock market. But just to put this in perspective, what has happened in interest rates, in the 90s, you could get 7% on a 2-year treasury note. by 2006 and 2007, even though Greenspan had lowered interest rates and then began to raise them again. In 2006, you could have gotten over 5% on a two-year treasury note. Today, you're getting a little over 0.4%. So since the 90s, interest rates, and especially on short-term rates, have fallen almost 95%. So with this low return investment environment, and in combination with bear markets, retirees have fewer assets at retirement, so they're forced to look at lowering retirement expenses, which would include reducing taxes and also living expenses. I mean, you take a look at housing and taxes, that's almost two-thirds of the majority of retirement expenses. Let me just put this in perspective. Let's say you wanted to earn $3,000 a month back in the year 2000, and you wanted to invest it in treasury notes. You would have had to have $540,000 to produce roughly $3,000 a month in income. Now, 2006, interest rates had come down following the tech bubble. Of course, they were starting to go back up when Greenspan began to raise them in 2004. But in 2006, you would have needed about $700,000 to produce $3,000 a month in monthly income. In 2014, given the rate of where two-year treasury notes are, John, you would need almost $8 million, actually $7,964,000 to be exact, to produce the same level of income. Now think about that. In 2000, $540,000 produced $3,000 a month income. In 2006, $700,000 produced $3,000 a month in income. In 2014, it almost takes $8 million to produce the same amount of income.
You know, that is just absolutely astounding when you realize that you have to have almost $8 million to produce the same income that $540,000 would have done back in 2000. This isn't a large time period. We're talking about 14 years. What do investors do? You know, we've talked a lot about how stable things were in the 80s for investors, where you had decent interest rates and safe investments like treasury bills could get you something worthwhile. What do investors do who have been used to safe investments? Returns on the banks right now on T-bills. I walk into my bank and they're advertising, you can get a whopping boop boop. You know, it's like
nothing.
That's what it is. I have to laugh at it because they're actually trying to sell it, you know? Like, what kind of an idiot?
Yeah, hey, invest in a treasury bill and you can get 0.1%. Wow. You know, that's really going to cover the cost of living. But John, seriously, right now, looking at treasuries, a 3-month treasury bill pays nothing. So basically, you're giving your money to the government and say, here, have my money. Don't pay me anything, but at least it's safe. A 6-month treasury bill pays 0.04%. It doesn't even pay 0.1%. And a 1-year treasury bill is 0.08%. Doesn't even pay 0.1%. So it just goes to show you, you know, how dramatic this change in low interest rates is altered the outcome for many retirees. I mean, nobody, you know, I certainly in the year 2000 would have never thought I would see the day that we would see interest rates this low for this long. I mean, we saw that happen in Japan, but it's kind of like weather-related events living in California. Weather-related events were something that happened elsewhere. Hurricanes, tornadoes. Well, guess what? In California now, we have drought and we have fires. But anyway, it has dramatically altered people's retirement lifestyles. And, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. You know, individuals can't control interest rates. They can't control that environment. So it's just a different operating environment. Different rules apply. And it's forcing people to do things that normally they wouldn't be comfortable doing.
You know, you made a comment about the money being safe, and my thought is, well, yeah, but it's not really safe because inflation's chewing away at it, since the return on those dollars, if they're just sitting there or whatever the unit of investment is, they're not matching the inflation rate. So the buying power is going down. It's sort of a safe, not safe type of thing. But like you say, there's very little that people can do about Fed policy or the financial markets. They can alter some things. One of these is taxes. The other is cost of living.
Well, I mean, we are seeing more retirees move in this direction. And I think the two biggest trends that we're seeing in retirement today is many retirees, and we've seen this in the national polls, are postponing retirement. So instead of, hey, I'm going to retire at age 62, they're postponing retirement to a later age, maybe 66, where they can get full retirement benefits and Social Security. We're also seeing a move to work part-time. So maybe you retire, you take on a part-time job. But we're also seeing two other things happen. We're seeing a big migration of retirees moving to lower cost of living states in states that have either one, lower income taxes or no income taxes. Because when you can't control what the Fed's going to pay you or what you're going to earn at the bank, or let's say you don't want to put everything in the stock market, then what choices do you have? One of those is to control your expenses. How do you do that? Well, you can move to a state where the taxes are lower. You can move to a state where the cost of living is lower. So, you know, there's two sides of the equation. There's income and expenses. If you can't control so much the income side, well, maybe controlling the expense side is an alternative. And we're seeing more of that done today.
Because, you know, the politicians get somewhat vindictive when you do that. You can see this outrage that they have that somebody should not want to pay their, quote, fair share. But you do. You read about celebrities moving to states like Florida. I mean, we have a huge influx of Californians here, so much so that a third of our population in this part of Idaho are now ex-Californians. Tiger Woods, what, started in California, goes pro, gets endorsements, makes money. Hello, Florida. And, you know, because you get pretty much the same thing you can get. It's sort of a swap. You get to keep the ocean. You get to keep the heat with a little more humidity than you have in California. You get rid of the earthquakes. And all you have to do is put up with the occasional hurricane that wipes everything out. I mean, it's not a big deal, but
yeah, it's the same. Tornadoes or.
But you're saying it makes sense. And a lot of retirees are doing the same thing. And indeed, states such as Florida and the state of Texas on the Gulf Coast, Texas, has also been making the same pitch to Californians. You know, other states are trying to do it as well. If you don't need a warm weather climate, there are states in the northern part trying to do that. So what are the choices that we're seeing right now?
Well, I mean, you can either go to a state that has no income taxes, states like Washington, Nevada, Wyoming, South Dakota, Texas, Florida, and Alaska. And some states structure their income taxes differently. Some states like California have a very progressive income tax rate. Some have a flat tax. Since 2013, believe it or not, John, we've had five states that have lowered their income taxes, Kansas, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, and Wisconsin being among that group. One state raised their income taxes, which was Minnesota. So you really have a choice here. You can move to a state, very popular retirement destinations, Nevada, think of Las Vegas, think of Reno, where Tesla is building a new factory. Texas is very popular. Florida is very big, especially on the East Coast, where people live in high tax states. And then when they retire, you know, they want to get out of the snow. And why not go to Florida? It's a lot warmer. Temperatures are better. And guess what? You pay no income taxes. And the cost of living, in many cases, much, much cheaper. So we're seeing this as an alternative to retirement, where people are moving to places where it's cheaper to live and they pay either no taxes or low income taxes as a means of reducing their retirement expenses.
I know you're a person of privilege, Jim. You have the privilege of paying the highest tax rate of all the states in the country, 13.3%, which is a reason for a lot of the exodus of taxpayers. I think retirees, some companies have been doing that as well. It's a combination of taxation and regulation, because talking to people that we know that have owned farms or dairies in California say it's just gotten absurd in having to deal with all of the regulations that we have to deal with, and also to fund state projects such as we have to be the ones who collect everybody's deadbeat dad checks and things like that. And, you know, they say the paperwork is just unbelievable. Half the time they can't get the job done because they're trying to comply. So that's why they're doing that. So this is really reasonable that you should do that. You know, I was predicting a long time ago. Remember here on the show, we were saying sooner or later, California is going to wake up and they're going to try to create an exit tax. In other words, when you leave California, they'll give you this whopping tax to try to discourage you from doing that.
Well, actually, John, California used to do just that. If you, let's say, spent your working career in California and then decide, okay, when I retire, I'm going to move to Texas. It's cheaper. I pay no income taxes. California used to tax your pension. So even though you were living in Texas with no income taxes, California was taxing your pension. Eventually, they went to the Supreme Court. Somebody took it, and the Supreme Court disallowed that. So California cannot tax your pension. But who's to say who would stop them from starting it again? I had one client who had a business here who was thinking of leaving the state of California. He actually had to go to a law firm. It was almost 12 to 15 pages, John. You would have thought he was trying to escape, you know, the Soviet Union in terms of the things he had to do, sell his property, make sure that his new house was bigger than the house he had here, divest himself of property just in case California would go after him and attach his home. So, I mean, California is very aggressive. But, I mean, you take a look at it, and we're seeing this right now. A lot of the high technology companies in Silicon Valley are relocating and building new factories in Austin, Texas, which is becoming a technology sector. We just heard in the news recently, Tesla got tremendous tax breaks for building their new factory in Reno, Nevada. So it's not just that people are looking at no taxes, but they're also looking at low taxes. And in addition to that, they're also looking at the lower cost of living. I mean, you just have to take a look at the different expenses, the different taxes, and all of a sudden, all these things, when added together, become a major factor in your retirement expenses. And as we said, you can't control what the stock market's doing. You can't control what central banks around the globe are doing in terms of quantitative easing, driving down interest rates. Let's put it this way. The interest rates in Europe, ready for this one, folks, at a 500-year low.
Wow.
That's right. I'm not making a mistake. Interest rates at a 500-year low. So imagine what this has done to a lot of people in their retirement. They can't control that. They're not going to control what Janet Yellen's going to do or Mario Draghi or Abe's economics in Japan. So what they can control is their cost of living expenses and their taxes.
You know, it is interesting because there's what I call the California virus. Having lived in California for a long time, I can say that. And I left California. One of the reasons is I wanted to be at a place where you couldn't see the air you were breathing, you know, but then.
Or how about being stuck on a freeway? I can remember I had to go up to Irvine the day after Easter for a business meeting the following day. And John, I left at 9 o'clock at night thinking, okay, 9 o'clock at night, you know, my GPS said 61 miles, 47 minutes to get to my destination. I left at 9 o'clock, 5 minutes on the freeway. It took me 2.5 hours of driving and stop and go traffic to travel 61 miles because everybody that had come down to San Diego for vacation or visiting relatives was driving back to Los Angeles. 2.5 hours. So, you know, some of that is what you see. You breathe it. It's called exhaust.
My traffic problems are a little different than that. This morning, my daughter and her husband have been living here because they've sold their house in Coeur d'Alene and they're moving closer to where she teaches at a college in Spokane, Washington. My traffic problem this morning is I had to shoo the moose out of the front yard so she could get in her car. So
you got moose problems. Okay.
I got moose problems because they come at this time of year for our trees. But anyway, we moved to Colorado. Colorado in the late 70s was a real sleepy little area. It was sort of nice. The skies were clear. Rocky Mountain High, John Denver, the whole bit. By about 1990, you suddenly saw this massive influx of Californians fleeing the high tax rates, you know, the situation in California. In Colorado Springs, a huge number of Christian ministries moved out of California and moved to Colorado Springs or to Orlando, Florida, one of the two places. Jim, I kid you not, all of a sudden, overnight, the politics started to look more like California. The freeways got clogged, and we had traffic jams all of a sudden, which hadn't been too germane there. Taxes began to rise. The cost of living began to go up, and the quality of life began to drop. So almost 20 years ago, we relocated to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, which was a sleepy little town. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, it starts out that way, though.
And you know what? It happened again here because what happened is because of what was going on in California. You know, if you sold your $1.5 million condo in San Diego. Let's pick an area, 1.5 million condo, which may have 2 or 3 bedrooms to it. You could come up here and buy 10 acres in a 4,000 square foot house and pay cash for it, you know? And we began to see this flood. And if we aren't seeing the same thing again, because what happens is Californians leave the state, but many don't understand what political situations brought them to that state, why they're leaving. And so they bring it up. And sure enough, our county now is becoming one of the more expensive counties, along with Boise, in the entire state. Why? Because we start to implement the same political decisions, and you see the tax rates creeping up again, and then they bring all the regulation, and, oh, we have to do this for the environment. We have to do this for that, and you always have to pay for it.
Well, you know, I was interested because you said you're getting a lot of Californians. Now, when a lot of Californians moved to your state, John, our income tax rate was 9.3. Yours is 7.4, so there's really not much of a tax savings there unless you're in the very high tax bracket, because we raised the tax rates here to 10.3 in 2010, yeah. And in 2012, we raised them to 13.3 to become the highest tax state in the country.
But we have a low sales tax, though. We have low sales tax and very low property tax.
Oh, okay. So,
I mean, those are the incentives. The problem, you know, you mentioned Washington has no income tax, and that's true, but it has a real hefty sales tax. And that's why people, I mean, I'm speaking to you from just 3 miles east of the border, you know, with Washington, and people come over here all the time to shop. Now they're supposed to pay because the Idaho tax is lower than the Washington sales tax. So, as a matter of fact, we actually had at one point here, people were running down to the Indian reservation, Kootenai Indians, to be able to buy cigarettes totally duty free and driving back with trunks full of cigarettes. And so the Washington state people got real upset at that, and they had the highway patrol out looking for people coming back from Indian reservations in Idaho with cigarettes to try to get them. But, it, you know, it's different at every state.
Well, I mean, the combination of lower taxes, lower cost of living is one way that you can effectively reduce significantly your retirement expenses. And there's a study that's done every quarter in terms of cost of living index. The lower the number, the lower the cost of living. And there was a study done, and they took a look at factoring in cost of living. They took a look at grocery cost, housing, utilities, transportation, health, and miscellaneous. And it's interesting that the top 5 states in terms of the lowest cost of living, number 1 is Mississippi. Its index was 86.2. Tennessee was number 2 at 89.3. Idaho, your state, John, was number 3 at 90. 4 was Oklahoma at 90.6. And 5 was Indiana at 90.9. Now, there's 5 other states. Utah was 91.6. Arkansas, 91.8. Kentucky, 92. Michigan, 92.1. And New Mexico, 92.1. Now, what I did is I went and took a look at the top tax rates in these states as well to see if there's a correlation between low cost of living and lower taxes. In Mississippi, the top tax rate is 5%, 6% in Tennessee, 7.4 in Idaho, Oklahoma, 5.25, 3.4 in Indiana, 5% Utah, Arkansas, 7, Kentucky, 6, 4.25 at Michigan, and New Mexico, 4.9%.
So I guess the real question is, where is it you want to live? And so the first thing you have to do is look at the high tax state and say, well, we crossed those ones off the list.
We did that, but it was interesting, too, because then I took a look at what were the most expensive places to live in the country. Number 1 was Hawaii. Its index cost was 158.9. Connecticut, number 2, at 141.6. D.C., Washington, D.C., 138.2. Alaska, 132.2. New York, 131.8. California, 127.8. Massachusetts, 124. New Jersey, 124. Oregon, 123.8. Rhode Island, 122. Vermont, 117. Maryland, 117.5. And New Hampshire. Now, I also looked at the tax rates. The most expensive state to live in is Hawaii. Its tax rate is 11%, very close to California. Connecticut is at 6.7. District of Columbia is at 9%. Alaska is 0. New York is almost at 9%. California being the most expensive, 13.3. New Jersey at 9. Oregon at almost 10. And Vermont at almost 9%. So there does seem to be a correlation between high tax states and high cost of living states.
Well, there seems to be a correlation. I mean, as there is a correlation between cost of living and taxation, because if taxation is high, businesses pay more, cost of living is more. You know, it's always sobering when you look at, remember how politicians a few years back were talking about the evil oil companies? And they just failed to point out that the biggest profits from the pump are made by government in the form of taxes. But you can't tell, because when you look at the little amount that's on the dial, you know, how much you pay for a gallon of gasoline, it doesn't tell you. And this much is tax, and that much is what you're paying to the oil company, blah, blah, blah. So any other factors, though, of what we should be looking at right here?
Well, I mean, there is. Usually high tax states, the correlations are higher cost of living. You see them on both coasts, the West Coast and the East Coast. They also tend to be blue states. So, you know, if you want to talk about enhancing your retirement lifestyle, one would be to move to a low tax state or a no tax state, and the correlation with the low cost of living. So if you think about it, taxes, mortgage expenses, living expenses, that's almost two-thirds of your retirement budget outside of, as you age, medical expenses become more expensive as you get into your 70s. So moving from a high tax state to a low tax state or no tax, or a high cost of living state to a low cost of living state, John, really can make a significant outcome on your retirement. And also, it puts you in a position of something that you have some control over. Like I said, you don't have control of what's happening in the market. You have no control of what's happening with interest rates and what Fed policy is. But this is one thing you do have control over.
Well, as is our want here on the program, that means we want to do it. Let's put into practical function what we have discussed here. And we have a case study, as we always do, of course, using fictitious names, but covering a real life event. Jim, the background.
We're going to call this the case of Bob and Nancy Richards. Bob is age 65, Nancy age 62. Bob got an early retirement package from basically a biotech company that got bought out by a larger pharmaceutical company. And he got a early retirement package incentive program in terms of getting like almost 1 year's salary in terms of leaving work. So it created incentives for Bob to retire early, not to mention the fact that Bob had a heart condition. He had a heart attack. You know, it's under control. He's taken medication to reduce his cholesterol. So there was a combination of health, stress, and the company offering an early retirement package. And the plan was to basically live off the early retirement package with Nancy working an additional year, and then at age 65, start collecting Social Security 1 year earlier than full retirement age, which would have been 66 for him. But their annual expenses were about $85,000 a year. I know if you live in the Midwest or someplace else like Texas or Florida, that seems pretty high. If you live in California, folks, it's very tough, unless you bought your home early, which they did. So the assets we had to work with in terms of meeting retirement expenses, they had roughly about $70,000 in cash. Bob had rolled over his 401k into an IRA. There was about $700,000 there. Nancy had a 401k of about $230,000, and then Bob had company stock of about $168,000. And of course, they had their home in Rancho Bernardo, roughly about $950,000 back in the booming decade, the last decade. That home was actually worth over $1 million, but the rough value was $950,975 with about a $300,000 mortgage. So here was the problem: $650,000 of equity tied up in the home, and also with a mortgage on it, mortgage payments were roughly about $1,500 a month. So there's $18,000, not real high, but still an expense. And property taxes at 1.1%. So, you know, almost a little more than a third of their retirement budget was $28,000. Now, here's the issue. They had one son in Phoenix with grandchildren, two daughters living here. Both of them were golfers. Their friends had moved in. They made the tax inversion earlier, moving to Sun City West, Arizona. So they'd often visit them, and they often thought of, gosh, homes there were a heck of a lot cheaper. Income taxes, I think it's $160,000 in Arizona, where you move into the 4.5% tax bracket. It may be even a little higher than that. But under that, the tax rate is only 2.5% versus, let's say, 9.3%. So this was something they were keeping in the back of their mind. They didn't want to take a lot of risk. trying to get that kind of shortfall in their budget from what they had in assets saved up, especially having gone through the downturn in 2008 and 2009 and having experienced that. There was no way that they wanted to put everything in stocks. They didn't want to put anything in junk bonds. So they had a tougher time. You know, part of the option would be that Nancy would work for a longer period of time until, let's say, she was age 66 and could take retirement benefits. So they were looking, and especially given Bob's health, that he had a heart attack and had coronary heart disease, of retiring at the same time.
Well, it seems like this is an issue with many California residents. Their home is their major asset. I mean, who would have thought at any one time that having $1 million, I remember this, take it back 30 years in California, that being a millionaire would mean you don't have enough to live on. You have almost $1 million tied up in a home and another million in assets.
Once again, this goes back to this issue of a zero interest rate environment. As I mentioned, in the 70s, you got 7% on a 2-year treasury note. In 2006, you got over 5%. Today, you get 0.4%. So interest rates have come down on the safe type of assets that retirees used to put a lot of their money in, CDs, treasury bills. You know, look what's happened. Interest has dropped by almost 95% as a result of global quantitative easing. So, you know, this is why a lot of people have had to alter their outcomes for retirement, either work longer, postpone, work part-time, or move to places where it's much cheaper to live.
Okay, well, that's the problem. What did you do for the solution?
Well, I mean, they sort of had a tentative plan before they came in to see us. I mean, Bob had a 1-year salary early retirement incentive, and so he retired at age 64. So basically, it was to begin taking Social Security at age 65. He'd get a little over 90% of his full retirement benefits. And then Nancy would get 80% of her Social Security at age 62. So between the two of them, 16 for Nancy and about 24 for Bob, was $40,000 of Social Security income. Now, if they converted everything they had to fixed income, they were in a bond fund in cash when they came to see us, getting roughly about 3%. So that still wasn't cutting it. So even if they put everything in a laddered bond portfolio at 4%, they would barely make what they were doing. They would have roughly about $84,000 of income, all in fixed income. But what were they going to do with inflation? So they were barely covering expenses. Now, they brought up the fact about selling their home. They had a 3,600 square foot home. All three kids had moved out. Obviously, they didn't need the bigger home. And also, they had a significant amount of equity. And they also realized, and especially with their friends living in Sun City West, Arizona, that you could live much cheaper in another state and significantly when you downsize the size of your home. So they were already leaning in that direction. So they were thinking of not only selling the house, but also let's look at the idea of what happens if we relocate to Arizona. Now, they spent a lot of time visiting their friends there, playing golf. And so when they came to see us, we took a look at the numbers, and it just made a whole lot of sense. First of all, you'd free up a lot of equity in the home. Two, you'd move to a state where you could live probably at almost 1/4 of the cost of what it was costing them to keep the big house. The income tax rates would be lower. The property tax rates would be lower. And also, they would be closer to their son with grandchildren. Now, they had two daughters here that lived in Southern California. So they went out and we recommended that that's exactly what they did. And they did put the house for sale. They sold it. That freed up a little over $600,000 after closing cost and commission. They were able to find a older home in Sun City West, roughly about $180,000, $20,000 in upgrades, kitchen, bathroom to bring it up to date, granite counters, update the appliance. So roughly, you had about $200,000 that would go into housing. Now, here's the key thing. Number one, they had moved from a 9.3% income tax bracket in the state of California to roughly 2.5% in the state of Arizona. They would move from a 1.1% property tax to a 0.5% property tax by Arizona. And here's the most important factor. They would eliminate almost $18,000 in mortgage expenses. They would eliminate almost $9,000 in property taxes. That alone, John, would reduce their budget by $27,000. So the new budget, instead of 84,000, would become 57. Now, if you subtract from 57, there are 40 grand in Social Security, that left roughly about 17,000 as a shortfall. Well, anybody that's lived in Arizona knows that from probably June to middle of September, it's not a great place to live. You're talking about temperatures 112, 113, 115 degrees. And of course, they had children here. So the idea was buy the home in Sun City, which they did, and then rent condos here during the summer months and get out of the heat. It was sort of the best of both worlds. So what we did, this freed up an additional $400,000 of capital. They came out of their house with about $600,000. $200,000 went to pay cash for the Sun City West home. $400,000 was added to their existing IRAs, 401ks. So now we had roughly almost $1.6 million to play with in terms of investment income. 60% went into fixed income at 4%. 40% went into stocks at 2.5%. That produced income over $50,000 a year. But their budget went up by roughly $18,000 a year because they would be renting a condo here in San Diego during the summer months to escape the warm Arizona weather. So here, John, was a case where two things happened. Number one, downsizing and moving to a state where the cost of living was significantly cheaper. Housing was cheaper. Food was cheaper. In fact, if you look at the cost of living index, according to this latest survey, Arizona's cost of living index was 100, and they left California where the cost of living index was almost 128. So not only were they paying lower income taxes, lower property taxes, lower housing costs, overall cost of living, whether it was looking at groceries, housing, utilities, transportation, healthcare costs, significantly lower in Arizona versus what they were paying for in California. So downsizing and moving to another state made the world of difference in this couple's retirement plan. Next to heart disease, cancer is the number two killer of Americans. Is it genetic? How much do we know about it? Joining me on the program is Dr. Georgia Sadler. She's clinical professor of surgery at UCSD Moores Cancer Center. You know, doctor, I guess research, clinical studies are ways the medical profession learns more about a disease, what causes it. Let's talk about some of the clinical studies and how those that are older have yet to participate as much. And let's talk about the implications of that, if we may.
That's a great and a very important topic, Jim. One of the challenges we have as we go forward trying to find ways to prevent disease, detect it earlier, figure out whether it's genetics or environment or lifestyle, we need to have data. And clinical trials are the engines that provide the entrance to new knowledge. So they're really important. But they're really important for people who are senior adults, and I say by that 50 and older, because what you see when you look at the data is that as people get older, they are less likely to take part in a research study, and yet it's even more important to have them represented in a study. As we get older, we have other diseases developing. Some of our organs aren't working as well. Our immune system may no longer be as robust as it was when we were 20 and 30 years old. And so knowing how we respond to whatever the intervention is really important.
Is there a particular reason why older folks do not participate in these clinical trials? Is it just reluctance, unawareness? Why so little participation, if I may ask?
I think if you look at parents with children who are terminally ill, deathly sick, they will do anything to try to prolong their child's life, appropriately so. As we get older and as we get toward the other end of the spectrum of life, we say, you know, I'm happy. I've had a good life. You know, whatever is going to be is going to be. Let's just take the standard therapy and go forward with the standard therapy. The problem with that approach is that we will not make the knowledge gain for older adults that we've made for children. The mortality rate from leukemia when I was growing up was 100% for children. Today it's 80% and getting better every day. So trying to do the same thing for people who are over the age of 50 The only way we'll make equivalent progress if we have people taking in studies to provide the data.
And how do you get older folks to become more aware of that, of the opportunity and also the benefits ultimately for everyone? Is it just a matter of public education, referrals? How do you get that participation rate up?
It's a combination of things. One is educating the public, as we're doing right now. Why should any of your listeners think about taking part in a clinical trial? Their doctor may invite them. They may see a flyer. They may hear an announcement on the radio or television. That's the time to ask for more information. I'm not suggesting that every time you hear a trial, you join it. I'm urging your listeners to pay attention to invitations to take part in clinical trials and then proactively get involved in learning more about the trial and if the trial is appropriate for them. And if it's appropriate, then it's really important to seriously consider participating, because many of us, as we get older, we develop other diseases which actually make us ineligible to take part in some studies. So for those of us who are able to get involved in a research study, it's really important that we at least seriously weigh the option of doing so.
Now, is there a particular preference that maybe somebody has a disease or doesn't have a disease? When I think of clinical trials, doctor, I think of somebody poking needles in me or doing things that are painful. So let's talk a little bit more about what goes on in these trials.
There are many different kinds of clinical trials. For example, there's a clinical trial about eating properly. When you have cancer, we don't know 100% what we should tell the patient to do. So research is exploring, how do vegetables and fruits improve your outcomes with cancer? How does treating depression when you have cancer improve your outcome with your disease? So a clinical trial can be as simple as a fork study. Does lifting your fork with the right food make a difference in your outcome? All the way to the other extreme of saying, does this drug or this radiologic treatment make a difference? Or even, in what order should we deliver the various treatments that you will need? Should we do surgery first, radiation, or chemotherapy first? Sometimes we don't know the best answer based on data. We have a guess, but we don't have data to say that's absolutely the most efficient way of treating your disease.
Doctor, is there anything that has come out of the research and clinical trials that have been done that lead to a conclusion that maybe diet, lifestyle play a significant role in cancer? Or is it more genetics that, you know, if your genes are bad, you're more prone to having the disease? We heard recently in the last couple of years about Angelina Jolie, who got, for example, DNA testing and decided to have a mastectomy as prevention. So is this the route that we're going?
I think you're absolutely right. We're getting more sophisticated about how we understand what happens in the disease process. So for people like Angelina Jolie, well, you can say, what a shame. On the other hand, you can say, my goodness, was she lucky to know that she had that gene? It's a time bomb for her. So would it go off? We don't know, but it's just sitting there ticking. What else would cause that gene to trigger into a breast cancer for her? And those are the kinds of questions that scientists are always asking. We know that you don't necessarily develop breast cancer if you had that gene, but the odds are very good that you will. So then the next question becomes, okay, well, we can treat it by doing a mastectomy, but I think everyone on the planet would rather do it with less aggressive and gruesome strategies. Wouldn't it be better if we could find a pill that would counteract that genetic abnormality, or a better diet that would counteract it? We know for diabetes, for example, if you have a family history of diabetes and you keep your weight under control, you follow a good, solid, healthy diet, doesn't mean you won't get diabetes, but you may delay the onset of it, or maybe you won't get it at all. So with cancer, we're always trying to find those nuances. Sometimes they're just little steps forward, but when you're the patient, a little step is huge. It makes a difference in your quality of life, which is a focus of many studies. How can we improve the quality of life of a patient coping with cancer, not just the diagnosis of the cancer earlier or the treatment more effectively, but we're going to have people living a lifetime with cancer. It's becoming increasingly a chronic disease. So we need to look at quality of life issues as well, not just let's throw everything at this disease and see if we can stop it in its tracks, but also which of these approaches and in which order will give the patient the best quality of life long term.
Doctor, do you think the way that we're going, for example, in the case of Angelina Jolie, where you go more and more towards DNA testing, I've seen advertisements on this from cancer centers on television, so you can find out early if you're predisposed to the disease, in which case you might take some mitigating steps, whether it's altering your lifestyle, it's your diet. And then, I guess maybe a secondary question would be, once you go to DNA testing and you're predisposed to the disease, is there something that, let's say, research or drug companies are working on where there's like almost like a vaccine or a pill that you take that maybe puts it off or delays it or eliminates the possibility?
Absolutely. That's one of the goals of scientific research, and it's an example of why we need clinical trials, because if you have a wonderful, brilliant idea, your institutional review board has said the benefits outweigh the risks of that study, and the community has a chance to gain from this, as well as potentially the participant. Now you have a study that's worth testing, but if we can't get participants in that study, there will be no knowledge gain. So at our cancer center at UCSD, we're constantly having to close studies that are very promising, because we do not have enough participants to keep them open. Other centers may be more effective than ours in that study, so they are successful in completing that study. But if we've been able to contribute to that database, it would have been done faster. So a lot of what we're talking about is rapid cycle improvement. How fast can we get the knowledge to make a change in how we deliver healthcare to patients with cancer? So if it takes us 3 to 5 years to get a sample, that's 5 to 10 years, maybe before we have a better treatment, because you need multiple studies to happen. It has to go through the Food and Drug Administration for approval. They may send it back for more testing. Today's most promising idea, at the pace that we're recruiting participants for studies, takes way too long, in my opinion, to benefit me personally. And that's what we all need to be thinking about. What's in it for me personally? If we can have rapid cycle improvement in all of our drug studies and all of our radiation and surgical studies, diet studies, behavioral studies, there's a good chance that the knowledge will come around full circle to benefit me. If we don't fill those studies quickly enough, it'll take the rest of my lifetime to have any knowledge that would have benefited me, and then it will be too late. So we all have something to gain. We all have community members who have something to gain from our participation, and we all have family members. And if you are looking at genetically influence, not always going to cause it, but genetically influence disease, who will benefit any more than our personal family? They are potentially the biggest stakeholders in this whole race for knowledge.
Doctor, I know that in the clinical studies, I'm interested in learning more about diet. There's been a lot of things that have come out that certain diets, oversaturated fatty foods or too much carbohydrates contribute to whether it's diabetes or other disease. Has there been a lot of research done in terms of, let's say, controlling cancer or after treatment of cancer, the likelihood of survivorship increasing as a result of diet change, lifestyle change? Has there been a lot of research done in that area?
There has been. In fact, our own UCSD Moores Cancer Center has done a great deal of research under the leadership of John Pierce. And again, these are really important studies, but when people hear clinical trials, they shut off their ears and they don't go to the next step of saying what's involved. So recruiting for those studies was a challenge. Even more important is we need to have samples with great diversity. So if the study is composed 80% of people of Euro-white descent, we still won't know the benefit of that study for members of other communities. So having enough members of the African-American community, Asian-American, Pacific Islander, Native American, Hispanic American, and all the other diverse communities that make our country so rich, they need to gain from these studies as much as the folks of Euro-white descent. So if we don't have good representation, then they're not going to benefit either. And think about a study that maybe recruits 300 people. That's a large study. You would ideally like to be able to look at each of the racial and ethnic groups separately to see if they all benefit equally from the finding. some may benefit more or less from that intervention. And it's important to know who it benefits and who it doesn't help, because there's no point in giving someone a drug or putting them on a strict dietary regimen if it's not going to benefit them. So knowing who's benefited is really important. But if you have a sample of 300 people and then you try and break it into groups, each of the groups' numbers is too small to do meaningful statistical analysis. So you end up keeping the group together and then everything is averaged. So having enough representation from diverse communities throughout our nation is really, really important to developing findings that apply to everyone equally.
Doctor, are there different forms or modalities of treatment? I mean, we've heard about radiation, surgery, chemotherapy. Is there any other modalities that have developed in terms of treatment of cancer outside those three?
Most of those are linked to those, but as we're going forward, you're seeing other types of treatment. For example, cancer grows rapidly by increasing the blood supply to the cells. That increases the nutrients going to the cells, the oxygen and the food you take in. So if you have a couple of cancer cells and you add more blood supply, the cancer cells can grow more rapidly. So one of the interventions that's been developing for the last 10, 15 years or more is looking at how can we stop that blood supply. So instead of making more capillaries, more vessels that transport the blood to those cancer cells, that tumor, that cluster of cancer cells, how can we stop those blood vessels from developing, which will then cause the tumor to slow down and potentially starve to death? Just one example. There are probably 100 other examples just like that one that are in development right now all over the world. This is a very difficult disease to figure out how to treat because there are so many different varieties within the title cancer. When we had polio, we had one virus. We had one treatment and it worked 100%. With cancer, we have dozens of different kinds of cancers, and within each kind of cancer, breast, prostate, and so forth, within each of those, we have variations because a cancer cell starts by being a mutated normal healthy cell. So when it mutates, they tend to mutate differently. And so even within the diagnosis of breast cancer, you might have a gazillion, I'm being extreme, but you have many, many different kinds of cancer within that. And then you need to figure out which treatment is best for that kind of cancer.
Doctor, is there anything that we're developing, and I've read just a little bit about this, where we're developing technologies almost like smart bombs where we can direct the treatment directly to the cancer cells? I mean, if you take a look at the strides that have made in breast cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer, and early detection, we've marched a long way towards progress in arresting the disease and the survival rates.
Yes. One of our colleagues at the Moores Cancer Center looked at a mushroom. It was the jack-o'-lantern mushroom, I believe, and it was very poisonous. And he was looking at that mushroom saying, if I could deliver that directly to the cluster of cancer cells, I could destroy those without doing a great deal of damage to the healthy cells in the body. And that was years and years and years ago, but it's one that always stuck in my mind since it's Halloween. It always comes to the surface of my mind. And so it's an interesting way of looking at the cancer cells to say, what's different on the surface of that cancer cell? What's different inside the cancer cell that I could somehow easily identify? And then if I can identify cancer cells and differentiate those from healthy cells, now I have a strategy for deploying destruction that's selective. So it selects only the cancer cell and ignores the healthy cell. Those are additional examples of the kinds of research that are underway right now. And as we produce new scientists, we have a training program for students who are hoping to become scientists. You see this marching pipeline of people with completely new ideas about how to approach the treatment of cancer. So it's very encouraging when you look at where we came from. But the more we understand about this disease, the more frustrating it is to find a treatment that will take care of all the cancers the way we were able to do with polio.
Is there, in terms of, you know, we've been dealing with cancer for quite some time, and it's still the number two killer of Americans here in this country, how would you assess the progress that we've made? I just mentioned that, you know, with early detection, with ovarian, breast, even colon, or other forms of cancer, the survival rates have increased tremendously with early detection. So I guess being able to detect things early, we mentioned earlier with DNA testing, Angelina Jolie found out she had the gene that was predisposed towards breast cancer. Is this mainly the main progress that we've made versus, let's say, once diagnosed, the treatment?
The thing with cancer is once you have cancer, you have cancer. It doesn't necessarily go away. The goal is to keep it in remission, to prevent it from taking your life. And so winning with cancer, ironically, is dying of something else. So when you look at cancer, you're trying to achieve the goal of allowing the person to live as long as they can in spite of their cancer, which means until something else would kill you. So it's not necessarily curing cancer. It's allowing people to have a really good quality of life and a prolonged life in spite of having cancer. So if you have someone whose son or daughter is about to graduate, get married, have a baby, grandchild's about to graduate, whatever, if you can prolong that person's life 5 or 10 years, that's winning for that individual person. Even though you may not have cured their cancer, they've been able to live the normal extent of their life in spite of having cancer. And that's why a lot of the clinical trials that are looking at how do we do more damage to the cancer and less damage to the healthy cells are really, really important, because we're looking at that long-term trajectory of living long enough until you die of something else.
So in terms of trying to get more studies done, wider participation, different groups, so you can look across a spectrum of not only age, race, etc., ethnicity, outside of education, I mean, have the drug companies, sometimes financial incentives have been a means of getting more people to participate? Because, as you say, you know, if it was our children, we would do anything as a parent to prolong that child or aid in that child's recovery from any illness. But when it comes to ourself, I guess as you get older, it's just sort of acceptance and then, okay, let's get on with the treatments, but I can't be bothered with anything else.
When a person over the age of 50 has the option of taking part in a trial, and they're saying, well, I've had a good life, what we need to remind that person is someday their child, their grandchild, their nieces and nephews will all be at their age, if they're lucky, and they will benefit directly from the advances in knowledge that their grandparents made possible. So taking part in a trial is really believing in the future. It's really allowing the next generation to benefit from our experiences. It's just a giving forward kind of lifestyle, and I think just listening to what your doctor's saying carefully, and even asking, many physicians are reluctant to suggest a clinical trial because they feel their patient won't respond to it. Or they'll spend a lot of time explaining the trial, and then the patient will say, you know, I really didn't want to do that at all. So there's an opportunity for each of us as patients to tell our doctors that we're open to taking part in a clinical trial. It's also an opportunity just to go online and explore clinical trials on the internet and ask what's available in your community to find out what studies are happening. Call your local hospital, see if they have any trials underway, and just have a more open mind. My hope would be that clinical trials would be a household word, that everybody would know what we meant correctly. There wouldn't be any misunderstandings about clinical trials. People talk about being a guinea pig. I don't want to be a guinea pig. And what you don't realize is if you haven't had folks just like you take part in a clinical trial that proves that drug works, if you need to take that drug in the future, you're going to be a guinea pig because it wasn't tested on anybody like you. So there's different kinds of guinea pigs, and I would much rather be the guinea pig at the front end where there's constant surveillance of how that drug is responding in my body rather than the other end of it where everyone just assumes it's going to work and it may or may not work in my body the same way that it works in everyone else's body.
So if our listeners would like to participate, let's make it easy for them. What are some things they can do to find out if they can participate in aid in future studies of perhaps someday curing the disease?
First thing is to listen to the radio. There are often announcements on the radio, in their newspapers, but they can also call their local American Cancer Society, for example, and ask them for help in finding trials that they're interested in taking part in. For other diseases, diabetes, the American Diabetes Association, Heart Association, Lung Association, I think everything has an association in our regions of our country. Calling them and just saying, I'm interested in being part of a clinical trial. Can you connect me with someone who's doing it? The other thing is to call your local research universities that have medical schools attached to them where they're doing clinical research. Most of them will have a clinical trials office and expressing your willingness to take part. If you know you have an interest, for example, in breast cancer research or prostate cancer research, the other option is to call a scientist in your community and ask if there's any way that you can help out. Because it's not just taking part in the study, but sometimes you can become the spokesperson for your community. So I do a lot of work in my research with church groups. For example, African American cosmetologists in San Diego have been incredibly helpful in a research study here in getting the word out about breast cancer and early detection. Our Asian grocery stores have partnered with us. They allow us to send students that put up little kiosks every couple of days talking about cancer and what's important for the public to know. So it's not just the taking part in a clinical trial, but the other really important thing is becoming knowledgeable about a clinical trial so that we can extinguish the misinformation that's out there about clinical trials and get the community working on all wheels to understand that clinical trials, there's something in it for all of us. And we just need to figure out where we fit into that picture and then get involved.
Well, listen, Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. Some very great news to think about. And you're absolutely right. The more studies that are done, the more that scientists have a chance to study treatments, lifestyles, whatever it is, to gain a greater understanding of a disease, the further progress we'll make going forward. And looks like we've made some great strides when you think about some of the common cancers from prostate, breast, ovarian, and some of the others that we have talked about. I want to thank you for being on the program and all the best to you.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for raising this important topic with your listeners.
Well, hope you enjoyed listening to that as we were talking with the doctor. There's been some tremendous strides, when you think about it, made in cancer, heart disease. We're learning more about stress, lifestyle, diet, and also various forms of treatment in terms of prevention and also keeping the disease in remission. You heard the doctor talk about one of the goals is if they can keep you in remission, hopefully you live long enough that you eventually die of something else. But anyway, it's extending your life. In the meantime, well, we're out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.